Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, treating enlarged prostates by giving them a prostate attack. No scalpels, and it leaves men intact, if I can put it delicately. Brisbane had its first prostate attack recently, and one of the innovators speaks. He actually specialises in fibroid attacks, so women should listen up too. A West Australian dentist is hoping to take the federal government to the Human Rights Commission because he reckons the government is down on the mouth. Australia has high rates of what's called inflammatory bowel disease. Find out the what, the why, and whether you can come off the eye-wateringly expensive medications when you're feeling better. And which state or territory has the best health system? Well, Victoria is never shy about coming forward. They've tended to assume that their way of doing business is best, and that self-view was reinforced when, under national health reform under the Kevin Rudd government, it largely adopted the Victorian system. That involves devolution of power to hospital boards, a way of funding services which is based on the actual services that they provide rather than lump sums based on history, and not letting them to get to crisis point before sending in the bureaucratic equivalent of the SAS. So do Victorians have the best public hospital system? Well, a review by the prestigious King's Fund, a health think tank in London, has tried to answer that question. And the CEO of the King's Fund, Chris Hamm, is on the line from London. Apologies for waking you so early, Chris.
That's fine, Norman. Good to speak to you.
So is this colonial cringe, getting the King's Fund to review a health system here?
Well, we're an independent foundation, and we agreed to take this on the basis we could tell the story warts and all, highlighting both the benefits of the Victorian system, but also areas of improvement and where they don't do so well. So we produced a report really for Judgment Day, not for Speech Day, and it presents, we believe, an honest assessment of what goes on and what's been achieved.
One of the comments you make in the report is that there's lack of transparency in the Australian health system, and it's actually quite hard to dig out data to really find out how the system's performing.
Yeah, we looked at all the data we could get our hands on, and there's a lot of washing around the system, which is used for internal management purposes between the health department in Victoria and the boards running the local health services. But not a lot of that is made available to the public so people can see how well their local service is performing or how it compares with the other local services. That's not just an issue in Victoria. We believe that's actually a global issue. Certainly in this country, we're trying to do much more to create more transparency and to inform the public as well as those providing care how well they're doing and where they can improve.
So how did you measure the states against each other?
Well, we use routinely available data with all the problems that comes with that. We'd like to have a lot more about the quality and outcomes of care for patients and populations, but frankly, there's not enough. So we used a combination of data on things like wait times, access to care. We looked at activity rates and what's produced with the money that's available. We also looked at some data on outcomes like healthcare acquired infections and avoidable deaths. So it's an imperfect way of assessing performance, but it's the best that's available looking at the data that exists.
So before we get to the results on those, you talked to people on the ground about what their perceptions were of the Victorian system. What did they tell you? Because it is a devolved system. There's supposed to be quite a lot of autonomy at ground level.
Yeah, what they told us is this model that they call devolved governance in Victoria is both the greatest strength and perhaps the greatest weakness of the arrangements in that state. It's a strength because they've stuck with that model. It gives a lot of autonomy to the boards running local health services. They can make decisions appropriate to their population. The weakness is, though, it doesn't create a good basis for boards to share, to collaborate, to identify good practice, and then to spread it across the state. So in our recommendations, as well as giving an overall assessment, we make a number of recommendations for areas like this that Victoria can improve on.
I mean, there's 85 of them in Victoria. I mean, it's a small state compared to New South Wales, for example, which has got a larger population where they've only got 15.
Yes, and that's exactly one of the issues we've raised for consideration by the state government. Are there too many? Wouldn't it make more sense to bring them together? But I'm talking from a country that reorganises and reorganises and reorganises yet again its health service with all kinds of damaging effects of structural change when the real issues need to be about how do we improve patient care. So if you are going to reduce, you need to do it very thoughtfully to avoid that happening.
So what about the performance then of the Victorian system relative to the rest of Australia?
Well, with the caveat I've already mentioned, we don't have as much data as we would like to make those comparisons. Our overall assessment is that on most indicators, Victoria does as well as other states. And on a few, and particularly the costs of providing care, it does better. And in that regard, the system they've had for several years of activity-based funding, where Victoria was very much the pioneer that other states have since followed, is, we think, one of the main reasons why they've done so well to keep costs of treating patients down and to deliver more bang for the buck.
So just to go back over that, when you look at the various things like infections, meeting targets and so on, Victoria is kind of in the middle. It's neither fantastic nor terrible, or the scorecard is above average, but not hugely above average. But it's quite dramatic. Victoria is the benchmark for costs in Australia. It's the cheapest system.
That's right. So let me just reinforce that. I think on a lot of the indicators, you can't claim that Victoria does better than the other states. It's very much in the middle of the pack. But because of this long-term investment and early adoption of the activity-based funding system, where essentially you pay for what you get, that has helped to keep costs under control. It has made Victoria, arguably, at least at this stage, the most efficient of the Australian states, and that's something they can be proud of.
And so the other thing that you comment in your report is that while people think that cost cutting is bad and it's going to reduce safety and quality, that's not been the case. So they've got better, more bang for their buck and still have a safe system, at least relative to the other states.
That's right. But again, can I make the caveat here that that's based on the data we have about outcomes and quality of care. It may be there are other data we don't have which would paint a different picture. And we know recently there have been problems in one of the rural health services with the quality of maternity services,
this is
for
Bacchus,
example.
Which Bacchus March.
Yeah, that's right. And that's another reason why we are arguing that more transparent reporting of performance data about things like outcomes in maternity services has to be given higher priority, because it's about what somebody once called the disinfectant of sunlight, that if you are very transparent on things like public reporting of health outcomes, that will in itself help to improve care and quality.
And they sacked the board at Bacchus March, Jerwa Health Service, because of these 7 supposedly avoidable deaths in newborn babies. But that's really an exception now in Victoria, because they put in this kind of emergency management system for boards to mitigate crises. Without going back over what we were talking about, is it that element, or is it, do you believe, activity-based funding that's really done the job for Victoria in terms of cost control?
So we think it's 3 or 4 things together. There isn't a silver bullet here. There never is there? It's activity-based funding. It's the stability there's been in the system. And from an English perspective, we look enviously on a state that's stuck with its model of devolved governance and hasn't chopped and changed when things have gone wrong. And that's a risk, too, around these recent failures of care. Sometimes politicians look at problems like those that have happened around maternity services and they want to be seen to be doing something, so they change the organisational model when actually it's probably pretty sound. And what you need to do is look at the root cause. So in the case of Victoria, to summarise, I think it's activity-based funding, it's devolved governance, it's the boards having control, it's the performance management relationship between the health department across the state and each of the boards, and it's the leadership continuity. You have people who've been running local health services for many years. They've got the track record of experience, but that's not meant to be complacent. You need to have much more collaboration with these small boards in particular, working closely with the larger boards and benefiting from their much greater expertise.
And don't reorganise just for the sake of it.
Well, avoid reorganisations at all costs. That's a very clear message from our experience. You know, the core business is about improving patient care and population health outcomes. Reorganisation rarely delivers that.
Chris Hamm, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Chris is CEO of the King's Fund, a health policy think tank in London. And you're listening to The Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. Still to come, a new way of treating prostates and fibroids without surgery or drugs. Sounds too good to be true. Well, is it? Find out. But let's stay with health at a national level for a moment, because a Western Australian dentist, Patrick Shanahan, an oral health consultant, is planning to take the federal government to the Human Rights Commission because they've never put oral health into Medicare. Patrick is in our Perth studio. Welcome to The Health Report.
Thanks, Norman.
So what's the argument here? Because as far as I'm aware, the right to health isn't in our human rights legislation, is it?
How true. How true.
So are you just barking at the wind here? What's going on?
The UN Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 was put into place, and one of the fundamental rights was health. And the amazing thing was that when we looked at Australia, is the only developed country in the world that doesn't have some sort of formal human rights. And so when we look at health and the right to health, there's none in Australia. We have the Charter of Healthcare Rights, which virtually...
Okay, so that's fine. But so what's the point in complaining to the Human Rights Commission if they've got no jurisdiction to look at health?
How true. That's exactly it. And
so you're hoping this is a test case?
Well, exactly that. I think that's the whole issue here, I think, Norman, is that this is a test case, because I've yet to sort of see that the definition of health actually excludes the mouth.
Well, indeed. And what's your argument here for oral health?
Okay. Well, if you look at Medicare legislation, Medicare didn't put dental services into Medicare simply because it was unaffordable. That was the argument that was put by the Labor government. And that's fair enough because, yeah, if you had universal cover like you have with medical cover, yes, it'd send us broke. True. Okay, I can accept that. But what dental services really, when you think about dentistry separated from medicine about 300 years ago, if not longer. And so what we have is medicine operates independently, or dentistry operates independently of medicine. And dentistry is also outside of healthcare. So what we have here in Australia now is we've got 8 million people with chronic disease, complex medical problems, or requiring care. Now, the common denominator here is that when people are healthy, the immune system works very well, and it does actually protect people very well. But when people have medical problems, what happens is the immune system is compromised. Now, what we're also finding is that the people who don't use dental services, or least likely to, are the ones who've got all the medical problems. And what happens now is, of course, the oral health problems actually manifest themselves on the medical conditions. So what we have now is that the GPs are treating patients medically, when in fact we don't have any diagnostics being done inside the mouth. And the point is the dentists actually don't participate in healthcare, and they can't because the legislation excludes them.
So what's the Human Rights Commission going to do about it if they find
Well, that's precisely it, I suppose. The argument I'm putting forward at this stage is that the Charter of Healthcare Rights is, I suppose, supposed to be the alternative to having the right to health. Now,
So you're just to be clear here then, you're not talking about the occasional filling for a seven-year-old. You're talking here about oral health care for people with chronic disease. In other words, people who are already sick, for whom their oral health is really important to their health and well-being, and that they should be integrated into the system.
Correct. Because what we're seeing now with the microbiology now is that when people are healthy, we know that gram-positive organisms, gram-positive bacteria...
Like staphylococcus.
Gram-positive we're talking about here. We're talking about gram-positive are the good stuff, and they are aerobic. The anaerobics are, in fact, the bad boys, and they are gram-negative. Now, what happens when a person is healthy, the good bacteria, the gram-positive, predominate, and the gram-negatives actually are, in fact, they are actually at the lower order. What happens is it switches when people get crook.
So let's say people fall down at your feet with this argument, say Patrick Shanahan. How do you drag dentists into the system? I mean, to be fair, there's a lot of dentists and dental hygienists and dental therapists already in the system in public hospitals treating particularly kids. But, you know, in general, how do you integrate these two things? I mean, you're arguing basically for oral health to be integral for people with chronic disease in the Australian health system. How do you go about that?
Right. Well, I've been working for about the past 10 years with the AMA Council of General Practice. and they're on side. The committee have put forward, we put forward a ministerial submission to the minister.
So you get GPs to do dentist work?
No. What we're going to do is to create an oral health resource within healthcare which looks after healthcare. The dentist can look after the dental outcomes, but we need to have someone inside the health system who's got oral health expertise to be actually work with the medicos, because the medicos are responsible for medical outcomes. And if I actually was in charge of health policy, I would say you do not treat a person who's medically compromised without, in fact, actually sorting out the mouth first.
So you put the dentist into the primary care team in general
practice. We are exactly that. We are public health primary care. We are not dentists. We are actually into health promotion, prevention, and we're looking primarily at bacteria here. We're not drilling and filling teeth. We're looking at the invisible things. The visible things are the state of the teeth. The invisible things are the bacteria. And the thing that which does concern us now is that what's happening now is that for some reason or another, the normal bacteria, which are normally supposed to protect them, they're behaving abnormally. And instead of being protective, they are in fact becoming aggressive.
Well, Patrick Shanahan, it's a conversation for another time and a long one, but thank you very much for joining us. Good luck with your complaint to the Human Rights Commission. We'll follow it closely.
Thanks very much, Norman.
Patrick Shanahan, who's an oral health consultant in Western Australia. Recently, as far as we can tell, a Queensland man was the first to receive an innovative procedure for an enlarged prostate. The same technique has been used for fibroids in the uterus as well, but it isn't well known. Dr. Roger Livesey is an interventional radiologist at the Mater in Brisbane, and he's one of the pioneers.
There's a new procedure which has been developed in Europe to treat benign prostate hyperplasia, the very common condition of men of middle age. The technique is simply to get into the arteries feeding the prostate, fill them full of tiny particles, and this blocks the arteries and causes the gland to shrink whilst retaining continence and retaining the ability to ejaculate, which the normal treatments don't maintain.
They don't maintain? How come?
The normal treatment for benign prostate hypertrophy is the transurethral resection, which is scraping out the gland from inside, and that takes away the sphincter, the seal at the top of the gland, which when a man ejaculates, it stops the sperm going up and makes it go down. So therefore,
so it's like a valve, so you lose the valve, so it only goes back.
It only goes back, that's right.
How do you find the artery in the prostate?
There we are, that's a trade secret. But in fact, it's not that hard, and we're well practiced in it from other procedures. You feed small catheters into little tiny tubes.
What, from the thigh, from the femoral artery, or where?
Well, people who are doing a lot of them tend to use the arm, because going from the arm gives you a very straight line. You haven't got to do big curves and bends. You inject dye when you think you're in the right place. You do a CAT scan at the same time and you can see where the dye is and you know you're in the right place.
Okay, so you stick in the catheter in the radial artery in the hand and you feed it down through the aorta, down towards the pelvis where the thing is, and by some magic you find your way to this tiny little artery that supplies the prostate.
Yes, that's the one. Brachial artery commonly at the moment, just in the bend of the elbow.
So just take me through the risks of this procedure.
The risks, the actual technical risks of getting in and getting to the thing are very low. And the actual procedure, there's a surprising number of them been done now, hundreds, and they're not causing big trouble.
But not in Australia?
Not in Australia, no. You can cause ulceration. If you put the particles in the wrong place, they'll block blood supply to the wrong areas, and you can get ulcers in bowel, ulcers in bladder. There have been cases where people needed surgery to correct these problems. But so far as I know, nobody's done anything too terrible with it apart from that.
So the radiologist has got to be pretty sure they're in the right artery.
Yes. You know the technique. You know where the arteries are. You put dye in to see where they're feeding, and then you put dye in to do the little CAT scan to see what's actually being fed, and you know where you are.
So before you put any particles in, you make sure that what you're injecting in is going into the prostate itself.
Yes, that's right.
So these are little particles, what, just little plastic bubbles or something? Or what are they?
Basically, they're inert material and they just act as a mechanical block. There's various brands and sorts of them, but they're essentially tiny, tiny particles of plastic, half a millimetre.
So you're essentially causing a prostate attack?
Yes. We infarct it. It dies. The inside of it dies.
What happens to it all?
Well, somehow the body mops it up afterwards. It shrinks. The cells, once they're dead, they lose their water, they shrink, and then blood supply around it cleans things up, and the phagocytes, the cells in the blood, take all the bits and pieces away, and it all cleans up.
And does it destroy the whole prostate? I mean, one of the issues of benign prostate enlargement is men of different sizes of prostate. So you can have a really large prostate. How much tissue do you actually lose, and is it enough to get rid of the man's urinary symptoms?
Well, the evidence from overseas is that, yes, when you embolise the centre of it, you're embolising the gland tissue, not the capsule, not the thick sheath around it. And you embolise the lot and it all shrinks down.
Magic. Are there any side effects apart from the complications you just mentioned?
I don't think so, no. It basically produces a shrunken gland and restores urine flow and leaves one's sexual function as it was.
So the man walks out, gets in the car and goes home?
No, they'll keep a catheter in for a few days.
So they're catheterised and then you follow them up. So the first one was done by your colleague and you've been doing ones for fibroids for a long time, the same procedure. Explain what a fibroid is, first of all.
Ladies get them. It's a benign growth on the uterus. They're very common. Some populations have 50 to 70%. Ladies have at least one small one. They can get very big. They can cause terrible bleeding, menorrhagia. They can cause trouble just by their mass, and if they're in the right place, they can cause a lot of trouble getting pregnant in younger ladies, but they are benign.
And what's been the treatment before embolization came along?
Oh, there's various treatments. The most drastic one is hysterectomy, but short of that, you've got myomectomy, which is cutting out the fibroid and the associated piece of uterus and sewing the uterus together again. And there's hormone treatments, and if they're inside the uterus, if they're up against the uterine lining, there's a resectoscope. You can go inside and scrape them out.
So how successful is embolization for fibroids?
Extremely. We've been doing it for about 15 years now. We've only done a couple of hundred of them, but there's many tens of thousands done internationally. And very few side effects.
So tell me about cost here.
I do them for nothing. If I'm at a public hospital, I just ignore the cost of it.
How typical of a doctor in the public system. but seriously, if this has got legs, and I'm always hesitant talking about new technologies on the Health Report because you know things go wrong and you know there are commercial interests and what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not going to fly if it's going to cost a fortune.
Oh, it doesn't cost a fortune. It costs less than hysterectomy.
And the prostate embolization?
It shouldn't cost a lot either. The particles can be a few hundred bucks at the moment. The companies make a lot of money out of these particles. And the catheters and all the rest, but the actual consumables aren't too bad.
And I should get just a declaration of interest. You don't take any money from these companies?
No.
Ophthalmologists say that, you know, if a new procedure comes along for cataracts, it takes them 25 eyes to get good at it. How many prostates or fibroids do you have to do before you're good at it?
We didn't have any problems early on. We took longer to do it, and there was more fiddling around with equipment and discovering what worked and what didn't work.
So this is a wee bit disruptive, isn't it? You're presumably peeing off the gynecologists because you're taking away their business in with fibroids in the uterus, and now the urologists are being done out of a job because you're embolising the prostate.
The gynecologists of the Martin now are on side. It's good. I will say that some of the patients who come for the fibroid embolisation are somewhat unhappy because they've had consultations which have led to recommendation for hysterectomy and had to find out about this for themselves.
How often do you have to repeat the procedure with fibroids to do the job?
We haven't for years.
And Roger, do you know if it's happening elsewhere in Australia or is Brisbane, as always, leading the way?
There's some being done down south. I don't know how many. Elsewhere in Brisbane, there's occasional ones being done, but the referral isn't there. People don't get referred, and it's just too hard. The thing about the prostate is I'm sure once the power group of men knows that there's this treatment out there which will leave them able to have sex properly still, then there'll be some demand for the procedure.
You've got to get referred. Roger Livesey is an interventional radiologist at the Mater in Brisbane. Inflammatory bowel disease affects around 1 in 4 Australians between the ages of 5 and 40. It can be incredibly disabling with pain, weight loss and even malignant change in the bowel. The two commonest conditions are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And in recent years, new medications have come onto the market which change the way the immune system works and can control the symptoms of inflammatory bowel disease in some people quite well. Trouble is that they're horrendously expensive, and there are concerns that they may increase the risk of cancer as well. Ray Boyapati is an expatriate Australian researcher working in Edinburgh and is part of a team which has been trying to find out whether people can come off these drugs when they feel better. Ray is on the line from Scotland, another early morning awakening. Thanks for joining us, Ray.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Do we know what causes inflammatory bowel disease?
Well, we don't fully understand what the causes of this disease are, but there are a number of theories, and some of them have a fair bit of evidence behind them. Large genetic studies, including here in Edinburgh, have confirmed that inflammatory bowel disease has a significant genetic component, but that's definitely not the whole story, and environmental factors such as diet and infections may play a role. And we think there's fundamentally a problem with the way that the immune system works that leads to inflammation in the gut.
Diet?
Yeah, so again, diet, it's hard to tease out diet in studies, as you would know, but we think that diet does have a factor to play, and we think that the environment in general also has an important role.
Because it changes from country to country, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we know that the rates of inflammatory bowel disease is different in different countries, and this may be due to genetic factors, but also environmental factors such as diet. On a more sort of specific level to the gut, we know that the microbiota of the gut, or the composition of the bacteria in the gut, can change with different environmental factors such as diet.
And are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis two sides of the same coin or entirely different? When I was at medical school, we were taught they were entirely different.
Well, there is some overlap in some patients. We can't actually distinguish between the two, but they are fairly distinct conditions. Basically, Crohn's disease is inflammation that can affect anywhere from the mouth all the way through to the anus and can affect all layers of the bowel wall, whereas ulcerative colitis affects the large bowel only and really is a sort of more superficial inflammation with inflammation of the lining, the innermost lining of the gut.
So we've only got a couple of minutes left, Ray. Just tell us about this study, because you were looking at these new and expensive drugs for inflammatory bowel disease. Presumably, they can be quite effective.
Yes, they can. So there are some, it's an exciting time and the new therapies become available to patients, but we were looking at specifically at two types of medications, immunosuppressants like azathioprine and 6-mecaptopurine. And these are medications that have been around for some time, and also anti-TNF or biological agents, which are the more expensive ones you talk about, like infliximab and adalimumab. Now, one of the most common questions that patients ask me in clinic is whether they should continue or stop the medications once they feel better and are in remission. And this isn't surprising. Not many people like being on medication if they can avoid it. And in some places like the UK, guidelines actually specified that gastroenterologists consider a trial of stopping medications for those patients in stable remission every 12 months.
So what did you find when you reviewed the evidence?
So firstly, I've got to point out that this was a review of the existing literature, so any conclusions are really based on the quality of the reviewed studies. One of the important findings was actually that some of the studies were quite poor quality because they were either small or retrospective or both. And so the results do need to be interpreted with cautions. But there are three sort of key findings. Firstly, studies with long-term follow-up showed that high rates of relapse were there irrespective of which medication was stopped. And this indicates that stopping therapy shouldn't really be done willy-nilly and it really should be done in a carefully considered manner. And it also highlights that stopping therapy in patients with a remission in inflammatory bowel disease needs to be personalised. For example, if I said to you that you had a chance of relapsing, let's say 50% in 2 years, you might think that's terrible, but some people might say, you know what, I'm willing to accept that risk.
And then they'll just go back on the drugs. And I suppose it depends on the side effects that you're getting and balancing that out as well.
Absolutely. So the other issue is, of course, balancing it with the side effects. And some patient groups have higher risk of long-term medication side effects. And in these patients, there might be a lower threshold to stop these medications.
So the message is expect relapse, but not everybody will get it, and balance this up and talk to your doctor about what it means for you as an individual.
Yeah, that's right. I think it really highlights the fact that it is a personalised decision and it all depends on a combination of how patients feel about their medication and their disease, as well as the chance that an individual patient develops long-term risks. But I think it also highlights the need for sort of more well-done prospective and controlled trials. And there's trials such as the BioCycle Project, which is a multi-centre European study here in the UK that shed more light on this subject.
Ray Boyapati, thanks for joining us on the Health Report.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Ray Boyapati, who's an Australian researcher working in Edinburgh as part of a team that's been looking at inflammatory bowel disease. This has been the Health Report. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'll see you next week.